Welcome, everybody. This
Yeah,
is episode 30. Can you
is it?
believe we've been doing this for 30
Yeah,
weeks?
yeah. It's what have you learned in all this time, Kevin?
That this is kind of like a therapy session for me.
Okay. Yeah.
And I don't know, it's definitely fun for me to even just personally just talk through a lot of these things, a lot of these things that I've forgotten over the time, and it re reminds me. I also do listen to the every single episode at least like once or twice, and that just kind of ingrains the kind of the knowledge that collectively we all have on here, and we also have had some pretty good guests. So I actually am a listener to the podcast, which is, I know a lot of people can't stand their own voice, but I
Yeah.
guess I can.
That explains the views.
What's that?
That explains all the views.
Yeah. I
All
think it's
those ones
fun.
from the East Bay in California.
Yeah,
So many.
but also I think another learning is that there's not a lot of content like the stuff that we're putting out. I think the things that are resonating with, so we have a pretty solid, it's not a massive following, but it's like a solid update listening to every single episode. And I think that it's due to the experience that we have, the candor that we have, which I think is very
Yeah,
rare.
yes.
And just for people that are looking to not make the same mistakes as we have.
That's right, yeah.
So I think that's why we have some sort of audience, and it's definitely growing every week. So that's great.
Andy, what about you? What have you learned?
I get to learn from your collective experiences. I get to hear the stories that you've all shared. I think I learned a lot from listening to Kevin's stories about Chip. I didn't attend that episode, but I consumed it. And I think it's just you get to hear the collective wisdom of the crowd. And I think in a lot of ways, I feel like I'm not alone a lot of times. And I didn't know you all very well prior to this, and I've gotten to become good friends with everyone here. I also wanted to just give a little shout out to Ryan, who's been live tweeting everything. Congratulations, Ryan. We watched you finish your floors in a course
He's
of
not
a
done
Twitter
yet.
minute. Oh,
He's
he's
not
not
done.
done yet.
No.
Podcast. Podcasting, baby.
One of these days he's going to be a guest appearance.
So I heard he's like a ghost wandering the halls, and one day he may show up. And so I know that we're in the thick of things. I'm more like operating right now. Like I've got over a year of runway working on my thing, building and hoping to hit milestones. Y'all are recently hitting milestones and much closer to the market than I am. What are
Yeah.
you seeing out there these days? Are you seeing a hard ass market like 2008? Are you seeing a market that is starting to recover? We know what the numbers look like, but what does it feel like out there?
It feels like people are dying slowly. And I think if you have a good business, that's great. Also, the capital markets are still pretty tight. So what we've actually decided to do, so we're in Series B territory. Instead of raising like a traditional Series B, we're looking to raise a smaller amount, and still grow at the same growth rate, but keep the team flat, which is extremely stressful because that means that everybody needs to do a lot more with a lot less. But that's kind of the market out there, and you have to follow it, or you'll be one of those people that just kind of goes down. So
I know
I
finding
think it's an
myself.
opportunity. I'm very I think it's if you have a good company, this is the time to be opportunistic, but also very thoughtful on where you're spending capital and everything.
I will say I'm certainly finding myself like really restrained in the way that I act and the way that we spend money at our business. I am watching the burn rate go steadily down as
You make money.
our MRR starts to improve. And especially that first $1 million in ARR, that's a really tough number. And also it's so important for the burn rate, because your burn rate is probably, if you're a venture-backed company, like 100K, a couple hundred K per month, or maybe higher if you're on the high end. And going from 0 to 10, 20, 30, 40, 50K MRR, all of a sudden it goes from your burn rate being not affected at all and just being the raw stuff that's the raw costs to being meaningfully dulled. And that is a super empowering thing, because the difference between your 200K in burn 1 month, and then if you're operating and it turns into 100K in burn a month, that's a gigantic change in your runway that you're experiencing while that's happening. And I'm watching that a little bit happen right now, where I send out investor updates, which I always do exactly on the first of the month or before, and it'll be like, we have 16 or something months of runway. And then the next month I'll be like, we still have 16 months of runway. And then the month after I might be like, I think we might have 17 months of runway. And that power is something I haven't really felt in the same way this way before. This is new to me, because Breather was obviously a totally different type of business. It was going huge with huge burn, and this is not what we're doing here.
How do you, just question on that, how do you compensate for growth, right? Because as you get larger, growth becomes, it's a percentage of your existing customer base. So you're going to have to either build different products, spend more in marketing. How do you compensate for that still growth or increased growth?
And actually, internally, we have this dialogue sometimes, because someone will say, if you have bottom-up feature adoption like we do at Practice, because it's solopreneurs, right? And so randos, like anyone, will come in and be like, this doesn't, I can't connect with PayPal, would be a really simple thing that someone might say. And we have to choose between customer experience when someone comes in and building something out that is more revenue generating. Because PayPal, connection is not going to drive revenue for us, for example, right? But so it's really hard to say no and have restraint with people that are asking for endless features and then things that are going to drive revenue. So for example, in the next couple of days, we're going to remove the credit card paywall for the first time, which will bring us from, I want to say, well, certainly several hundred trials to possibly even 500 trials a month or 600 trials a month or some number like that, a gigantic change.
Right.
And so what I have learned in running this business, especially this is bottom-up SaaS is a very particular beast where you need such big raw numbers. No single deal is ever going to save you. I can see Andy nodding here. No single deal is ever going to save you. So it's like, I look at all these people, PayPal happens to be a thing that people have requested since the beginning, right? And so we've said no to all these people at PayPal. So have we lost 20 deals as a result of doing this? Maybe, but does 20 matter in the grand scheme of things? No, when I'm trying to get to 1,000, at scale, like 1,000 trials a day, right? Which is really what bottom-up SaaS means. And then the other thing is, you got to do what Aaron Ross and Jason Lemkin wrote in Impossible to Inevitable. It's like one of the classic SaaS books, which is you have to increase your deal size. It's one of the only ways to really drive meaningful revenue. I could see the both of you really agreeing to that, but I'm learning it for the first time with software. At Breather, it was certainly true. We had to increase deal size, and that really got us somewhere. But here, we had to be deliberate about it. So we built a team product, we built a pro account, all these things that would drive an increasing revenue for a customer per month. So those are a couple simple things.
And your thoughts on that? You have bottom-up SaaS as well.
So I haven't gotten the PayPal request. I would love to dive in on that one on another, some other time, why people think they actually need that. I think we prioritize big lift features. So one of the big lift features that allowed us to move up market was Microsoft Office Auth. So historically we were Google only. Now we have, we allow our user base to sign up with Microsoft. And I think that was a big lift. I think there are a lot of distractions along the way. And I think what our product team does a very good job of, and myself included, is what is consistently coming as feedback and as feature requests. Because I think one-off users can request anything, but you need to do things that enable you to land and expand, get bigger deals. And as Julian said, I mean, it's a numbers game in bottoms-up SaaS. I mean, I can just imagine, I can just imagine what it's like to be at Canva with the amount of traffic they have to drive every year to get $1 billion of revenue.
Yeah. I mean, if you're Dropbox, right? That's why it's really, and it's so,
it's got to be viral.
When you're a revenue generating kind of founder like myself, like that's like every time at the beginning, I would always begin extremely low prices, but I would also begin with a lot of free usage and be like, just try it out and hopefully I'm going in the right direction type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then what occurs is at some point you're like, okay, I got to really open the floodgates here.
Right.
And at practice where we are today, I'm just like, we no longer have conversations about single features. We no longer have we have more conversations about how is the business model going to evolve.
Right.
In order for, so we have to go from credit card trial to $1 trial, and then now no credit card trial. And then it's going to be like, is freemium going to be after that to expand the number of people coming in even more? Each one of those done in a tactical way, not just like flippantly thinking it's magically going to save us, because I have no illusions about like things like freemium, of course, because I'm an operator, right? And so it's really like tactically looking at the, we work very strongly with the growth model.
Yep.
And we look at it and we're like, okay, well, it needs to go from 100 to 500 trials. That was in the past, but 100 to 500 trials in a month. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what is that going to take? And so foundationally, what must we do in order to get this working? Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so those are like, I don't know if I would be able to lead. Well, I'm confident I would not be able to lead as well if I had not run another business before that. Where we looked at everything from the perspective of a financial model and been like, what does it really take to go from here to here? I used to make fun of VCs, right? And be like, why do you need a financial model? What is the point? We're just making it up. Now I understand. It's because you're looking for assumptions and you're trying to test against those assumptions to see what's possible.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, the way that I look at it is it's a company. Well, so We kind of were bottom up. Now we're mid market, and so now we have companies that will pay us, I don't know, like $500,000 in net revenue a year. So we're able to use an outbound motion, which if you can do that, that's really important. So the way that I look at it is that you have a few different levers. You definitely have like the product, which like how do you go up market? How do you get more people? How do you get the same size people, more of them? Then the marketing, which is going to be like, how do you actually track them? How do people find out about you? What different channels do you have? Do you have partnership channels?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have, is paid going to be a portion of that? Paid, unfortunately, has probably a pretty, especially if you're in a competitive market, it's got a pretty low ceiling. So, and then also for you guys, especially for me as well, I think like for us, referrals have been such a huge portion.
Yeah,
so that's like a function of your product quality as well. And then, you can have other things like press, which like good luck getting stuff like that today, which is not going to happen. That's honestly how Ship grew so much, but that's just really not an option.
The only press I ever get is press that was like, this company is going to die as soon as something that, you know, I never get good press with anything I do. New York Times famously, talk shit about Breeder for years. So I wish I could take that word.
And then
tell you the truth.
Right. No, nobody can. Unless you're in the hype cycle, which just don't be in the hype cycle.
Kevin, I dig into outbound a little bit, because it's something that we have to begin operating on here, prospecting, all these other things. This, by the way, this is super tactical inside baseball things, but I think really interesting to a certain percentage of listener base. So when you went from a bottom-up motion that had a certain, probably a referral element that had a certain...
It was all paid initially, all paid.
Right. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you went to an outbound motion. Now, what started to happen and how did your team get good at it? How did you find the first success? Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, so we definitely didn't go from paid to outbound. So we're only just starting to really ramp up our outbound strategy. Mm-hmm. So before that, it mostly was referrals from Fortunately, our industry in e-commerce, they have a pretty big community. So when they find a service that they, product or service that they like, especially in our industry, which is like notoriously like really terrible companies, they're really, they're excited to refer other people, their peers, to help them out. So I'd say that that was like the biggest channel. And then we have, we went partnership route first, and then we're probably only, I don't know, like 3 to 4 months into our outbound model.
Okay. Yeah.
And but that's going to be the one, just based on the size of customers that we are going after, that's going to be the one that's going to be the most sustainable. The paid acquisition stuff, it's going to be a portion, a percentage of your revenue in any business. But
of course,
you're just going to get competitors that are going to outbound you or outbid you if you're on Google. And there's only, if you go to the podcast route, there's only so many podcasts that you could actually advertise on.
Right.
So that's why I do like mid-market enterprise companies now, because like outbound, if you have a really big market and you have a really good outbound market, I look at companies like Brex as like the kind of the pinnacle of the one of the best outbound motions. They just had this huge TAM and they had a really simple message and product, and they just went super hard at it, and they were able to build a really big company around that. So I think it's definitely an evolution, but I think the first thing is focus on your product, make sure it's 10x better than anybody else.
Yeah.
And then you should invest in all these things. The one other thing that I did miss out, and which it sounds like you're doing, Julian, right now, is like optimizing your product-led growth, your kind of onboarding referrals and all of that for your SaaS, which is another way to.
Andy and I have talked about this. Andy and I have talked about this offline, about how PLG, people think of it like, people in product especially that don't look at growth and financial models, look at it like a little bit of a miracle drug, right? But you also have these pretty sophisticated people. Elena Yusinov, is that her last name? Elena Verna. And so she's one who I think is quite realistic. We spoke to her directly. And she was like, for example, don't do freemium unless you've got 12 months to make it work. At which point you'll see revenue from freemium, right? But with the financing, I don't want to say it's not really imminent for us, but with the financing less than 12 months away, probably, I want to operate on things that'll drive, like, revenue scale will be needed for the next financing of this business after 10 million in 10 million raise. So you have to do those things. You cannot think about them as miracle pills that will occur. And if anyone is going to say something pretty aggressive, which is, if anyone is out there saying to you, freemium in your business in an early stage, you have to be like, well, cool it, my friend, because here are the illusions that people have about freemium, right? And so, being taught by the best people is really the move, and to be sharp about it. Andy?
Yeah, no, I agree. I shoot DMs to Elena, and I've spoken to her a bunch of times. I think she's awesome. I think she has really good content on LinkedIn. Plug to her also here. I read it all the time. I think people have this idea that freemium is a magic bullet and product-led growth actually means the product is going to grow itself and there's no marketing involved. And the reality is the worst thing people did out there was rename self-service to product-led growth because the reality is you, 30% of my traffic comes from referral or word of mouth. But 70% we have to drive. And so how do you do that? You have to play with your marketing channels. What do you have to do very differently in a self-service or quote-unquote product-led business? You have to get to a place where it's so simple and it's so consumerized for people to get in, get to an aha moment, and put their credit card into your product and pay. That's basically the only difference. But in terms of a marketing playbook, you actually have to run a deeper marketing playbook. You have to really think about, how do you get demand to your website? And it's something I think about every day, in and out. And Julian and I talk about this a lot offline.
You are one of the people who's been driving organic search. And we have a big organic search strategy. And what we do is we go we used an amazing agency in the first year called Graphite, one of the best people in Silicon Valley for SEO. And now one of our advisors is the guy who was CMO at Zapier, where they had also a gigantic programmatic SEO strategy. And before that, he was CMO of Glassdoor, old friend of mine. And when you are bottom up like this, you really have to think about what are the scales that what are the channels I can create with a zero CAC? I could scale out with a zero CAC.
Yeah.
Or you have to improve your ability to get a high LTV in order to drive a non-zero CAC, right? So everything is really tied to the model is tied to the pricing, is tied to the channel, is tied to the customer. And if any of those four is like pulling too hard in one direction, it breaks the model and it breaks the ability to not get product market fit, but it breaks the ability to get the early scale that's needed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the place that we're in right now. I would say we're doing more right than we are wrong. But nonetheless, everything has to really line up. I know this already, but what you really learn from venture is lots of things need to go right. Even if some things go wrong, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of things in venture need to go right. For example, like your TAM thing, Kevin, that we went into with a ship failure. Lots of things went right, but one major thing went wrong, and it was TAM,
yes.
And that was unsolvable.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And so ideally, you've lined those things up before you start the business,
yes.
If at all possible. That's not always possible.
Well, right? And also, yeah, I also want to, so I think what we're talking about is like optimization, especially, so I see a lot of companies that get to a few million dollars in ARR and then just stall the fuck out because the TAM is a lot smaller than they thought. Mm-hmm. They've had, if you're pure software, it's relatively easy to copy what you're doing. So you're going to get a lot of competitors.
Yep.
And then your growth channels that you had, whether that be paid partnerships or whatever, they kind of dry up. And mm-hmm. so people just start stalling out, and then that's when you kind of need to sell the business or you need to iterate on the product. And so I've always had the philosophy, even at Ships, you need to create a 10x better product than what is out there. And you need to have some defensibility innate in your product. And then hopefully your TAM is big enough and people are willing to pay for it and all those good things. And mm-hmm. then all of the things will follow. I really don't like the idea of the lean. I don't know, this is totally related, but maybe we could kind of segue it there. Is like the lean startup methodology is just mm-hmm. kind of like put a bunch of shit out there and just kind of iterate. And that usually, like, I don't know anybody that's actually worked. I know like big pivots have worked, mm-hmm. but just like building one thing and then getting 100 users and yep. they're paying $5 a month or something. And then it's, oh yeah, this other thing. And it's like this kind of discombobulated product strategy that doesn't actually solve anybody's really real problem, which mm-hmm. is what kind of why I don't like that. So I think that you need, like, when you go and build a company, and this is what why I do tell like my friends that are wanting to build a startup, I'm like, don't fucking go unless you know exactly what you're going to build. What are you going to build? It's going to be 10x better than something else out there. And it's got to be a pretty big TAM. Because there's a lot of things that are going to go wrong. And the lean startup methodology, which is like big back, well, I guess, what, 10 years ago now? I dated mm-hmm. myself.
More, 15.
15 yeah. or something like that. It just doesn't, I don't think it holds any water today because you're just going to have so many competitors and software is so easy to replicate right now.
It almost feels like the right move. If you believe, like, I was reading that Derek Sivers book, Anything You Want, recently. And he is talking about hit songs, and he was comparing it's a very old example from CD Baby from fucking the 1990s.
Yeah.
He was talking about how he built his store by himself for his own CDs and for his friend's CDs. And then it just, over time, it built into an independent record store online.
Right.
And I think he got to 10 million ARR or some other thing like that. And the comparison that he makes a comparison to a hit song. And a uh-huh. hit song, quote unquote, has PMF in our parlance, the way that you and I would all speak here on this panel.
Yeah.
And if you aren't getting it, then there's no kind of amount of financing. It'll drive pivots, an ability to pivot. So it's almost as if you should take zero venture. And those are the people that we really see succeed. ConvertKit. Nathan over there.
Bootstraps,
who
obviously.
Is at a lot of ARR. I know the number. I don't think it was publicly disclosed, but it's a lot. And he owns a gigantic amount of it. And he was just like, yeah, I kind of have an audience. What do y'all want? What do you all want? And he just started building it. And he remained at zero burn the whole time going up, as opposed to hire 10 engineers and go and then try to close that gap on a timeline.
Right.
A completely different way of doing things. You can't do that with an AI meeting software like Andy, right? But there are lots of an increasing number of things you can.
Right, right. Yeah. I'll finish this one point. Yeah. And like, if you are in the venture and you truly want to have a venture like scale company, like you stalling on a 10 ARR is a failure. And so if that is like how big your market is, you should really maybe take one round and then just kind of run it and realize that's all the company is going to be, which is fine. And you may actually be better off personally doing that than raising hundreds of millions of dollars and having other things go wrong. Sorry, Andy. Just wanted to finish that thought.
No, I think it's very interesting. There's some great PLG companies that did this. Calendly is one that comes to mind. It was basically fully bootstrapped. Zapier is also one of these companies too. They did both companies did one small round and then bootstrapped their way to big growth rounds. Another one that's newer is Whimsical, if people have seen that product.
Mm-hmm. I've got a bunch of other ones because they're in and around my space, so I'll mention them. Kajabi is one of them that took almost no financing and just recently did a private equity round at a $10 billion valuation.
Mm-hmm.
There's one that has never taken financing that is called Dubsado, which is at 8 figures of ARR. And it is just, it's a competitor of ours, so I'm at peace kind of talking about it. They started and took zero financing, and it was all Instagram, not ads, all organic Instagram in the early days of Instagram, which brings us to try to find a channel that is kind of developing, right? Yeah. Which is what people did in the early days. I see Andy here trying to fix his mic. If you can piggyback off a channel, Evernote famously did this. It's not a great business, but it got there by being one of the first apps on the App Store. And that's why everyone is doing this AI thing right now, amongst other reasons. But one of the reasons is they're looking for a growth channel that they can piggyback off. Right, Kevin?
I think people are doing AI because there's so much funding available. I don't know what the actual channels outside of PR are for AI companies or getting bought by, mostly by Microsoft or something like that with partnerships. But I'm definitely not tapped into the AI stuff.
I feel like I am in the AI space. I went to Ben's Byte meetup last night. It was kind of entertaining. There were a few people. And so for anyone who doesn't know, Ben Tussle runs a great AI newsletter every week. And him and I have become friendly recently. And so I went to his meetup in New York last night. And I think basically 3/4 of the room probably didn't know what AI was, which was kind of entertaining just to be there. And then maybe another 15% could actually describe how these things are built and what they are. And I'm talking about a lot of the VCs in the room who were mostly consumer VCs before this AI wave. And so it's just wild to kind of see what's going on. It is the definition of a hype cycle. Maybe this is what the internet was like in 1998. Yeah. But it's a fun time. There's a lot. I truly do believe there'll be some very big, interesting companies being built. And I think Val itself could be one of them. Shameless plug for my own company there. So sorry, folks.
Yeah. And in your defense, you definitely have a lot of defensibility because all of your video, like you basically bolted on AI to a very big foundation of like video conferencing software. So you're not going to have a ton of new upstarts kind of coming into your space, which is great. I actually had the opposite experience. I went to a meetup last week, and there's tons of these now in San Francisco. And I kid you not, 95% of the people there were building AI startups. 95%.
Wow. I mean, they're looking, I get it. You know, and Andy, go.
I was going to say, I guess that's the difference between San Francisco and New York, number one. Yeah. Number two, I mean, there's so much going on in the space. I would be shocked if you weren't, if you're a core software engineer. Problems that were so hard when we were starting Nanit in 2014, and Nanit is a deep learning company,
right,
are so trivial and easy. And I mean, yes. I think about Vowel, and we didn't just bolt on AI. We've been working on this problem for four years.
Yeah.
And this has been our vision. When we started looking at transformer models in 2019, nobody knew what we were talking about. And I think that now almost everyone knows what that is, because that's what OpenAI has commercialized. And I do think we're problems in software engineering in general that were incredibly difficult, that would have 50-person teams, now are available to the average front-end developer. And so it is an interesting time to build. Yeah. And then it depends, what is the core backend? I think the funniest one, what somebody pinged me on to our group chat, and they were building a AI-powered curated pet marketplace. I don't know what that means. If anyone else out there does know what an AI-powered pet marketplace is, let me know. But I think there is a lot of different things going on in the space, from the real and some from real solving some real challenging problems for the end user, to bolting on AI in general to anything you can find. And maybe, Kevin, you should add AI to the logistics
market. I was just going to say, is it the new on-demand services of 2023? Added anything to on-demand, it was an instant fundraise.
Yeah, I think generally, and let's definitely move off of the AI topic, but like generally hype cycles, unless you've been building in the space like Andy has for so long, don't get into it. You're going to fail. There's so many people that get into it, and there's so much capital available and seems so exciting, and you should not be getting into it unless you have a unique perspective, years of building in the space. Like, you should not be doing it just because it's hot and it's what everybody else is doing and there's so much capital. That's a recipe for failure for you personally. And that's what I went through. Anyways, can we pivot to one of the topics that we had for last episode we never got to, Jillian? So we were going to talk about hiring. So we could kind of go through the different stages of hiring and what everybody has kind of, what their thoughts are, hiring, onboarding, offboarding, even how to build like a world-class team, maybe starting with your seed round. I don't know if who wants to start off with that.
I have a very strong position on this. Andy, I'm curious what yours is. You've hired a fair number of people as well. I will say my rigor, here's the thing that I think is a contradiction. I feel that everyone who is starting a business of any kind has a meaningful challenge where they're like, oh, I hired this person and it turned, I thought they were great. Oh, everyone, no one's hiring people they don't think are great. The moment that they are in the door. The question is, one, do they turn out the way you expect? And how can you optimize for them turning out the way you expect? And then second one is, how do you manage them to be able to become great or as great as possible? Third option is, how quickly do you show them the door, if at all, if they are not? And so those are the three factors. I will say that the number one thing that we are aligned on at Practice, we were not aligned at Breather, and that we did wrong at Breather. We still hired a lot of people. I think it was more by instinct, but a lot of good people, but there were also a lot of misfires. And it was by instinct and not by process.
Mm-hmm.
And at Practice, we're just 15 people, but we're very strong on the leadership team about our conviction for process-driven hiring. I was speaking to somebody at Andreessen Horowitz, and they were like, I'm not sure this is as good. I took it as a compliment. I showed them like a checklist that we work from, and the checklist is, oh wow, this is more rigorous than some pre-IPO companies I've seen in our portfolio, and so that's really rigorous. Clearly,
is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, for us, it's an excellent thing. because we get high conviction on people. And if we don't get that high conviction, we're like, we're out, and we pass on all candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it really has worked for us. And it's created some of the strongest hires that I've ever worked with in this
That's
team.
Great.
And now our focus is make sure everyone is A. And if not, have high conviction that they are not. And if we found that somebody that we didn't was on the team, I think we would be like, because after 15 or 30 people or some number, some scale, it actually becomes impossible to fix as a problem.
You can't.
That's actually some coaching clients that I have are at scale and trying to fix a problem of not enough A players on their team.
Right.
And at a certain number, you cannot, it's almost impossible to fix.
I really actually agree with you. I think the first 5 to 7 people you hire really set the tone of your company and your culture. And if you hire A players who are going to, they attract A players. If you hire B players, they attract B players. Touche.
Or C players. Because they're trying to actually protect their job. Honestly, that's what happens.
I would love to actually see Julian's metrics for how he hires. I think we've done a very good job of hiring A players, and they've done a very good job of hiring some great people too. I think we all make mistakes no matter what. And when you make a mistake, you have to realize it and change it. I think besides that, I think hiring, you start to know what looks good for a specific function and domain. And I think something that the biggest lesson that I've learned was from Michael from Skillshare was, who's Julie and I are friends, hell yes or hell no on hiring. Mm-hmm. So everyone knows, I think most people here have used like Lever or one of the ATS tools, and they have a scale on those things from 1 to 4. 4 being strong hire, 3 being hire, 2 being like, I don't know what it is, and 1 being don't hire this person. And it's sort of like, I don't understand why that scale actually exists, because the only thing that really should matter is strong hire or don't hire. And I think I've gotten there to a place where I'm very opinionated on I'm not hiring people, or I am going to hire this person now. But I was much less so in my earlier career. Mm-hmm. I was just trying to put people in seats. And now I focus on eight.
Mm-hmm. You were thankful that somebody would actually join your company.
Not at Vowel, but definitely more early days. Yeah.
That's what I mean. Yeah. I was the same way.
And then you try to fix it later.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can, and most of the time you can't.
Right. Yeah.
It's really fear-based. I could say this when you're a first-time entrepreneur. You're like, oh, my God, anyone wants to join. Kevin, I remember you talking about this a little bit in your first time.
Yeah.
And then it's a fear that I remember making a hire. I don't want to call anybody out from Breather who all – as a team, like they did really amazing things considering what we had. But really being like, I need this role by this financing.
Mm-hmm.
And having no other real, and maybe it was true, right? Maybe they were like, oh, well, this is a first time CEO. He needs this type of VP or something by that time. But in actuality, I thought investors were dumber than they are. And the result is you think that they're kind of appropriately deceived by smoke and mirrors, but I think they see so many deals that in actuality, investors are very good at seeing through bullshit. And they're able, for the most part, to see around corners, sometimes even better than you are. And so what
Very subjective, and top 10% of investors. Come on now.
But I guess my point is so you should not do something for optics. You should do it for an internal strong reason. Someone I know, one of our investors, was speaking to the CPO at Duolingo. His name is Jorge something. I forget the last name. And he was like, yeah, at your scale, like what is the number one thing that you worked on? You would think that they would mention game mechanics or some other tactical thing. But the top thing that the CPO at Duolingo was mentioning, Duolingo has been in the news a lot because they're so much better than they were. And they were like, keeping only A players on the team was the number one thing at scale. And you don't really understand it till you have someone if anyone's listening and they have never experienced this, or they maybe experienced it once and they don't really know how, when you are have someone that's an A player on your team, first of all, everyone is, oh my God, everyone on your team. They're like, I cannot believe this. Can you believe we have someone like this? I remember I was talking to somebody in HR about someone that worked for us at Breather, and they were like, people believe he's the savior of the business, right? That is the quality that some of these A-level people have. It doesn't mean they're perfect. Sometimes they have strong flaws, but it's okay. And if you don't have anyone like that that has this high conviction, then it's possible you have only B players on your team all the way through. You really feel it when you have one.
Sure. I agree with most of what you guys are saying. I like to address the different types of people that you hire for different stages of the company. So I'm really, and even like how you manage them as well. So I'm really, for seed stage and even Series A, I like to hire like more generalists that have you could see that they're extremely curious, and their slope of learning and growing is just like higher than anybody else. So I'd much rather hire those people than specialists. I think specialists are for when you have something that's working, you're looking to optimize it, you're looking to make it better, you know exactly what products to build. Those are the people that you're looking that to come from the other startups at your range. So they were leading product at Notion or something like that. Like that's when you look to bring them in. But those are actually really terrible early stage hires, because they're not good at not having a lot of resources. They're not good at being really scrappy. And I think that's what you really need to build like something, because you don't totally know. Like you found a company, you have an idea for a problem, you have an idea for the market, but you're looking, it's just not all you that's building everything. You're looking for the first, 5 to 10 people to really build that. And I think it's a completely different set of people. Like I guarantee you the people that started it at a name your successful startup, like the first 10 people at Stripe look nothing like what they're hiring now. Like
that particular, yes, I know that particular example of the first 10 people at Stripe. I met one of them, and obviously I met the founders, but I talk about the first 10.
Yes.
The story is they were all repeat founders. All
sure.
And yeah, so that's great. You just have a quality of person that is just, I mean, they've all, when someone is an operator and a founder, they act at another level. It brings me to a controversial tweet I was posting a couple of days ago, where people are like, this guy is, and by the way, I hate Twitter. I hate it so much. It's like people that are, it's the most unqualified people on the earth, all in the same room, talking to you like they know what the fuck they're saying, and they don't. So here is one of the things I wrote that is not even that controversial, I'm just paraphrasing. Like entrepreneurs, start to get comfortable with the fact that you work harder than people on average, and you're smarter than people on average. When you acknowledge this, you're going to get better at operating and the things you need to operate on. Oh my God, who is this? People respond like they're so fucking upset. And all that I'm saying is don't assume that people are at your level and will understand all the context you understand. Mm-hmm. That they'll be able to make connections the way that you can, and that you'll have an ability to turn anyone into a mini version of you. You can't.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I could go on like this for a while, but I think I'll pause. And
I'll take this one. I don't know if they necessarily need to be generalists, but I think 0-to-1 experience is something that they need to have, whether they're founders, whether they were product people who launched a product from scratch. I actually, Kevin's advice is very good, but it's a little bit more nuanced. It's, you could have worked at Notion and you could have inherited a product and you tweaked some colors and you hit a KPI. Let's talk about a product hire. But you could have also been the product hire that they gave AI to and said, build this from scratch. And so you've done 0-to-1. You've really basically lived a 0-to-1 launch. Very few people, though, at large companies have done 0-to-1, period. They inherit a product. They inherit a button. They inherit an app. Somebody else built it. So, like, it's great to hire the 9th designer on the Cash App team. But it's also kind of incredible if you could hire the first designer who built that Cash App. Because yes, they had a lot of resources, but they had to really iterate and get the product to work.
But see, here's the problem with that is that you don't know. They'll tell you that they were the first designer on the Cash App. You don't know if they actually did. And this is also another major problem that people get wrong is they attribute the success of a company that they came to that actual person. I've hired so many people that have the pedigree and they said they did X, Y, and Z, and it turns out they actually didn't. And they were just part of a team that did X, Y, and Z. So I would probably say no to that person unless I look for people that want either have started their own companies before or want to, or they have a ton of side projects. So they're, especially on an engineering side of things, they're just really curious and like they're taking something from zero to one or apply that to any other field or something like that. I think that I would definitely say no to the first designer at the Cash App as a first designer at a startup for sure, unless I knew them personally and worked with them.
Interesting.
Because the chances that they actually did all of the work, and just think of the cat, like they're working at Square with all of these amenities and all of these tools at their disposal, and it's just like they and also the chance that like if this thing doesn't work out, it's fine. You need to have people that are like okay with failing, and if this fails, like the company might fail.
See,
and
one of the things we always ask is, what was your role? We try to really drill down on that. Not that you were a designer on the Cash App team, but what was your role? What did you lead? What did you do on a daily basis? Who did you report into? And I actually think at this point with our networks, it's pretty easy to reference somebody blind to figure out if they actually were that person.
Yeah, sure.
Starting out 10 years ago would have been a lot harder for me, but we always focus when we interview, what was your role on this? Did you lead it? Or are you leading it with 9 other people? How did it work? And so on and so forth, because that is really what it comes down to. Because I hear you and I agree with you. If you're one of the people, if you were, there are a lot of the first designer at Square and Stripe and so on and so forth. But there is actually deep down somebody who was the first, somebody who led that. And they're probably no longer there. Mm-hmm. And so just some bit of a nuance point.
Andy.
So how do you cross-reference that with, I think this is Peter Thiel's advice, right? You need, as a startup, like the first, I don't know the first 10 or 20 hires, it's your job to find undiscovered talent. And that's the only way that you could really compete in this marketplace.
This
how
is
does
what
that
I was going to express.
Oh, yes. Okay, great.
So I totally, Kevin, I am with you. When they're not underpriced anymore, they've been discovered and
yes,
they are the stock that is hot now because they were the first designer at Cash App. So your job is to find the first designer at your thing that
yes,
is like the first designer at Cash App.
Right.
And so, by the way, I think we should do a whole episode on just hiring. It is, I don't know if it's my only superpower. Certainly, if I can be not humble for a moment, like I think I have a few. There's definitely some gaps I have. I wish I could do more, but hiring is one of the things that I am extremely proud of how I do. And I have strong rigor and conviction that I'm good. So how people interview others all wrong. While y'all were talking, you asked me a little bit, Andy, about the methodology. I pulled in some books that I read. I've read a lot of books about scaling and hiring people. I'll call them out right here. Scaling Teams by Alexander Gross. There's Who, which is one of the most famous one by Jeff Smart. There's No Rules Rules by one of the people at Netflix, Reed Hastings and Aaron Meyer. I could go on and on, but the most important one for me was Hire With Your Head by Lou Adler, which is an underknown, like underappreciated book, which was written by a recruiter and I think is a game-changing thing for hiring people.
Mm-hmm.
People are in interviews. My CTO today was from Amazon, and really they're legendary for being extremely rude in interviews, and they prepare it ahead of time at the beginning of the interview by being like, I will interrupt you nonstop. Mm-hmm. I am going to ask you questions. I'm going to stop and tell you you're off track. It's because they're looking for specific things and they've got an hour or 90 minutes to do it. At the very beginning, things like who was responsible for what is an amazing thing that you have to dig into, and you have to get the answer quick. I will literally interrupt anyone. By the way, some people might be like, I'll never work for Julian. I don't give a fuck if you fucking don't want to work for me. I find people that really do want to work with the way that I work, and we're doing really good. So I don't mm-hmm. care if it alienates some people. Mm-hmm. Better they should find out at the beginning.
That's true. That's totally
so,
true.
So anytime someone says we in an interview,
yeah,
I'm like, stop. Who is we? Over and over, I'll do it 10 times until they finally get the message and they stop and they're like, oh, sorry. What I mean is the team and I did this part. Thank you. That's the fucking information I wanted. People don't do this in interviews because they're trying to be so nice. Your job isn't to find nice. Your job is to find excellent.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also need to have a certain level of niceness and professionalism as well.
Hard disagree.
You would rather a bunch of prima donnas that are just like excellent at their job that like can't agree on anything.
People that are excellent respect each other's excellence. That's what Peter Thiel means.
Okay. All right.
Unfortunately,
I think we're all trying to say no assholes. Maybe at least Kevin and I are trying to say no assholes. Julian.
I'm agreeing with that.
Julian's actually a lot nicer in real life when you talk to him when he's not on the podcast. For anyone listening out here, he just puts on a little bit of an act when he gets in front of the mic.
It is not an act.
It's not an act. No, it's not an act.
Kevin's going to find out. He's going to go to lunch with me and be like, I hate that guy now.
It's not an act. I think to be a founder, like you need to have like certain things you believe in and believe in strongly. And also not everybody's going to be the same. Like the three of us have different ways of operating, hiring and the way that we think of things. And that makes us like we have strong, that's what makes us hopefully like successful. If we were all the same, we all agreed on everything. Like that's not good. But I think there are obviously certain structures to like things that you don't need to be unique on, right?
Certainly.
Hiring should be something like there was an interview I was listening to. I think it was Aaron Levy. There's certain things that you shouldn't really look to be unique on when you're building a company. One is like HR. Don't try to be unique on HR. Another one, I can't remember all the other things that he mentioned, but there's just like certain things that like just follow the best practices and like don't try to like recreate everything.
Agree.
And then you should be unique in like the way that you like sales was another one actually. He's proven enterprise sales is like something like just copy what the best sales like teams have done and get somebody who's done it before and then just scale it up. It's rinse and repeat like SDRs and you reach out to people and close rates and measure everything and then you pay people bonuses when they close people according to how much revenue they bring in. And so there's a lot of things in startups and we don't have time to go through the list here. But hiring is one that's people do it differently. And I think over time in your career, you hopefully get better because you also have what we have all had. We see what good hires turn out to be, right? Like our methodologies that we came in with, we're like, oh shit, that actually turned into something. And you have a feedback loop that you can then use to improve your hiring process. But I really do think that it's for startups, most of the advice that's out there is for larger companies. And you, like when you're building your first, to Andy's point, it's for 5 to 7 people, it's different types of people.
It is a different type. I really, all that I'm expressing is I think that people should be really rigorous with how they find them.
Of course.
Because when people go into interviews, it's like they lose all perspective. They see someone as a blue tie. They look at that blue tie. They're like, I got a blue tie at home. Whole interview becomes about the fucking blue tie.
Yeah. And also some people are just fucking amazing in interviews. And some of the absolute worst hires that I've made have been probably the best at interviewing.
Right. Or they've got a brand associated with them.
Yes. Yes.
That's the depth. That's why you get into the we question. We did this. Fuck you. What did you do?
Well, and also the way that I look at also managing and high, as you look, continue to scale, like I want to build a company that we, as we look to promote, we have 50% of people we promote internally into these management roles and 50% of people that we bring from the outside. And so I also want to look like I would be worried about that number one designer at the Cash App. Like, you're hiring him for a role that is he going to have enough to really bite on? Is this going to be like enticing enough for him versus somebody that like has been designing for, I don't know, 3 to 4 or 5 years or something and hasn't done anything exceptional in their career? And they could turn in, I've had this before actually. And then they've turned into my, I have a few people like this actually at Ship, and I could see this, that was turned in first designer, second designer, turned into become the director of design, then went on to be VP designs at now two other like very high profile companies. And it's just, you could just see, that's why I like to optimize for the slope of like their curiosity, their learning. And I don't like to really hire like named people unless I actually know them personally.
In, you know, in closing, the person we really need on the hiring slash talent episode episodes is Joe, because he, the bench that he has created
right
at Cloud, at Joy Mode, et cetera, is so unbefuckingly, ML Michaels, a bunch of other people that just turned out to be incredibly good careers.
Yeah.
And he got them. They were all undiscovered when he hired them.
Right. Cool. What should we end this episode with?
We just did. Be aggressive.
Enjoy the episode, everybody. Good at talking to you guys. I'll see you on Wednesday, Julian, or Thursday.
Take it easy.
All right. Bye.
Bye, everybody.